you think that I'll blow it in less than a year,
hello, how are you? Hope you're well. It's late Wednesday night, and I'm about to throw this episode up. I'm just recording the intro and outro real quick. It's like 1:30 in the morning. I just went and saw that Cate Blanchett movie, Tar. Really good. Really good. I sat through the entire movie thinking, how have I never heard of this woman? I really couldn't... The way that the trailer was presented and the way that the marketing for the film has been presented, I was like, is this a real person? Have you seen this? Have you seen the T-A with an accent over it? R. Cate Blanchett. Tons of Oscar buzz. Everyone's talking about how great she is in this movie. The movie's got great reviews, but it's not like a huge, big-budget blockbuster, but it's like an art house film that's doing really well by Todd Field. The way it was marketed, they were like, Cate Blanchett plays Lydia Tarr, the first female conductor of the Berlin Orchestra. And I was like, oh, like that sounds like a real person. No, it's not. It's a fictional character. But the whole movie, I was going, it feels like her performance is something where she studied a real person. And the script is just excellent because it's rooted in such a like immediate realism. But since the script is so, it feels like it takes place right now, like immediately right now, that the whole time I was going, how are they making a movie about something that's like, that maybe happened a couple months ago? Like, and I was like, how have I not seen this in the news somewhere? How has this not been? And it just turns out it was just a movie. But it's a biting satire and just really sharply written, wonderfully designed. The cinematography was stunning. The production design and the costumes were incredible. And Cate Blanchett was incredible. I hope it gets nominated for some stuff. I hope maybe she gets into the Oscar conversation. I hope they don't forget about Everything Everywhere All at Once, because you know we're heading into like October, November, December, where all the awards movies make their big push. And I hope that while these other movies pop in, I hope they don't forget the early greats that came earlier this year. I don't think they will this year. We'll see. Social and emotional learning. That's what we're talking about this week. It's the newest thing that right-wing talking heads and politicians are telling their voters that they should be afraid of, that's happening in schools, is social and emotional learning. This idea that and the way that it's being sold to people is that it's this that, like, teachers are indoctrinating children to think that it's okay to be trans or non-binary or gay, which it is. It is okay to be those things, but there are people who have religious convictions that it's not okay to be those things, and they don't want teachers telling children that it is okay, because God forbid we try to raise kind, compassionate kids. But really, social and emotional learning has always been an aspect of schooling and school, and I'm going to break that down with my friend Crystal, who's on the show today to talk with me about it. Crystal was an excellent guest for this. She really killed it. Conversation's good. We'll get to that in a bit. I just want, before we start, we talk a lot about Christopher Rufo. Chris Rufo is a guy that we talked about on the Critical Race Theory episode. Talked about how he was sort of the architect of the Critical Race Theory panic, and he talked about that openly on Twitter. He bragged about it openly. He's doing it right now with things like social and emotional learning, and he's really kind of leading the charge on trying to get people to support laws that take rights away from trans people, and specifically trans children, trans kids. And he's using very similar tactics, where he's just giving people sort of like blanket terms to couch their discomfort or their outright bigotry in, terms and arguments that sound more reasonable. And he's stating that out loud, that that's the strategy. And just so you know, that I'm not just making that up or saying that, here is Christopher Rufo talking openly about his strategy that he's currently employing, and bragging about how he employed the same strategy for critical race theory. This is Christopher Rufo.
What I'm looking at, and it's just kind of an ongoing series, I just started it, is to take that same system of reporting, that same style of reporting as I did with critical race theory, but now taking a look at gender ideology. What's happening right now is parents are feeling that. They're feeling the, oof, this is kind of weird. I'm kind of uncomfortable with this, but I'm scared to speak out. And so what we have to do is we have to give them the kind of media narrative, kind of a justification or validation or substantiation of their concerns to say, hey, this is the kind of thing they're teaching in schools. And then we have to give them the language where they can speak about it with confidence. They can speak about it directly, and they can speak about it with the requisite level of aggressiveness that it's going to take to say, hey, wait a minute, we have to stop this.
Yeah, I just thought it might be good to hear that before we have this conversation, so that the whole time you're not going, who is this guy? Who is this guy they keep referencing? It's that guy. And what he's saying right there is exactly what I said he was saying, and what I said he was doing is he's saying, hey, look, people, parents already have sort of an underlying discomfort when it comes to like the issue of trans people and queer people, and they don't really know how to talk about it, specifically because they don't want to just out and out say, I don't like queer people, because that sounds uncouth, and it would sort of mean that they would have to acknowledge or admit that they are prejudiced or potentially even just full-blown bigoted in some way. And so when people struggle to communicate their discomfort with a historically marginalized community because they don't want to sound – and people don't like to think of themselves as being prejudiced or bigoted. So they're struggling, looking for some way to give – name to this feeling that they're having, or to be able to continue to other these people, but in a way that is couched in an argument that feels more reasonable. That's what Christopher Rufo is saying that he comes along to do. It's like, well, I come along and I give them a thing. I say, you don't need to say out loud that you're afraid of you know, racism being – the history of racism being taught to your kids, the reality of America's history with racism being taught to your kids. You don't need to say out loud that that makes you uncomfortable, because I know that that makes you sound bad. So what I'll give you is this idea of critical race theory. And that's what he's doing with these issues as well. So yeah, that's kind of it. We break it down more in the conversation, so I don't need to go more into it. Let's just do it. Let's just jump into the conversation with Crystal Luster. How about it? Here we go. From a Blanketfoot recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my friend Crystal Luster about social and emotional learning. All right, what's up, everybody? Welcome back. We're here on YouTube. We're doing it. Video's here. Crystal's here. I'm here. I'm back in the studio. I'm back. I'm back in LA. I'm back in the blanket fort, baby, and it feels good. All right, I got my nice microphone again. I got my headphones. I got the nice camera. Crystal's looking good. We're feeling good. How you doing, Crystal?
You know, it's chilly here in the Windy City. They don't call it the Windy City for nothing. Well, they call it for something that has absolutely nothing to do with the cold, but it's cold, so I'm good.
Is that where you are? Are you in Chicago?
Yeah.
I didn't know that that's where you were. You're in Chicago. Okay. Yeah. God, that is the coldest place on earth, I swear to God.
It's not that bad. Honestly, I live for this weather. All of the allergens die. I get to wear my fall fashion. I got all the sweaters and fuzzy socks. I'm in heaven.
This is my favorite time of year too, but I live in Los Angeles, and like this is when it gets to like 65 in LA or like 70, and I'm like, that's what's up. And it's gonna be this from like now till May, and I'm like, yep, let's do it. Light jacket, maybe a sweat. On certain nights it'll get down to like 60 and I'll wear a sweater. I can wear a sweater with a light jacket, but like, don't need it to be any colder than that. Yeah. Ever. None of that Chicago bullshit where I can't look up because it's so bitter cold that I have to keep my head down and I run into a street lamp because I can't – you know what I'm talking about?
You know, what really happens is that you just – as long as you have on glasses, you'll be fine, because then you can see like the wind and the ice and the sleet won't go directly for your pupils, and you can see where you're going. And then and you just leave little slits open for your eyes and everything else is covered and you're good. You're good.
Yeah.
I love it.
All right. Great. Yeah. What's your favorite thing about living in Chicago? What do you like most? The food, the culture, what?
There's so much to love about Chicago. Chicago gets a lot of hate. I can't lie. A lot of people hate on Chicago, but
I hate on Chicago all the time on this podcast. I talk mad shit.
Chicago is amazing, first of all. The people here, there is a very creative energy here in Chicago that a lot of people don't know about, because you hear, you know, the buzzword cities, you hear Atlanta, you hear New York, you hear LA, but you don't hear about Chicago like we should. We deserve more credit there. We have the best food on the planet, period.
Like, okay.
Tell me anything different. We have all cultures here, all little like cities and pockets of people, and anywhere you want to go, any type of food you want to eat, you can have it here in Chicago, and it's amazing. And we have amazing music here. And again, I can't lie, I love the change of weather. I went to LA once, like right after Christmas, mm-hmm. and to see Christmas decorations up with no snow was just the most bizarre thing ever. I was just like, why are you guys lying like this? This is weird. I dream of a white Christmas every Christmas. And when I don't get snow, I'm very disappointed. So I love Chicago.
I'm from Utah originally, and we definitely do all four seasons there, and we definitely have it. But I think that's where I learned that I was like, no, I'm good. I've done enough scraping the ice off of my windshield in the morning for a lifetime, for 10 lifetimes. Are you from Chicago originally?
Yes, I am from Chicago, born and raised. And
all right.
I mean, you know, that's where like automatic start comes in. You just, you know, get your car all warmed up and it'll defrost for you. Just.
Yeah.
Have a makeshift ice scraper out of a CD case, like chipping away at
The CD case. Have you ever used a credit card?
anything with a sharp edge I have used. And let me tell you, you get creative when you're cold and you have to go. And I've also done the thing where like I've run late. And I've just got like a tiny little hole that I've chipped at because I don't have time to chip the whole thing. So I just chip enough of a hole for my face to see out of the windshield. Yep. And then, you know, everything else is a prayer until so I get to my destination.
That's my thing, is like, there are times in the winter growing up in Utah where I would just be like, well, I might die on my way to work today or on my way to school today. Like, I have to, I got to go. I make that little hole for my, or I have the defrost on long enough that I've got like the little hole that I chipped out and the little hole that the defrost has gotten to. And I'm like, I'm going to be late if I don't leave. Yeah. So I'm just driving down the street the inside of the car is also freezing. So it's your breath is in the car and you're hunched over looking out of a little teeny hole in the windshield on streets where your car is fishtailing as you come up to like stop signs and, you know, but that's what we do.
It's an adventure. You know? You have to look at it as an adventure. Like when I'm driving like that, I always imagine myself as Jim Carrey in, was that Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, or Dumb and Dumber? When he's like, Ace Ventura. When he's like hanging out of the window driving, that's me in the wintertime. And then, you know, when your car is driving. So quick, funny story. I got my license in September of, and I got my first car in that December. So it was freezing cold, snow, ice, all the things. So my dad takes me to an open lot and to teach me how to drive this car. And he's like, all right, you know, put it in drive and then go really fast. Now turn hard. And I'm like, but Dave, just turn hard. So we're spinning around, going around. I'm like screaming and he's sitting there laughing. And then we finally slow down and he's like, that's why you don't spin hard when it's snow on the ground. And you know what? It was the craziest, most unorthodox lesson, but it made me so comfortable driving in the snow. So you just have to adjust. You
know, my dad potentially killed me and him.
We're going out together. Yeah.
Have you ever watched Arrested Development? Have you ever seen that show?
I have.
And there's the whole thing where like the dad tries to teach the kids lessons when they're growing up. He'll be like, that's why you don't yell.
Yeah.
And it's like some guy gets his arm cut off. It's always a guy, they have a friend who doesn't have an arm. And it's always that guy getting his arm yanked off. And he'll be like, that's why you always leave a note.
It's your brain that way. It just, you know, because if you tell them the right way, they don't know. And then they do the wrong thing. And they're like, why didn't you tell me? Well, now you know. So it works.
Oh, man. Okay. So you and I know each other through the internet. It's sort of this weird thing that we do where when you start making videos on the internet and you start getting traction on the internet with more people watching your videos and more people following, you meet all these friends that you've never met in person, mm-hmm. and you just start like commenting on each other's things and sharing each other's things and messaging each other about, oh, I like this that you did, or, oh, did you see this? What were your thoughts on when they rolled out this thing? Mm-hmm. You know, how did you get into that stuff? Did you kind of fall into it accidentally like me, or were you trying to do that stuff and you found a groove?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I've been doing content for the last 10, 12 years. Mm-hmm. I am a musician by trade. So I started out with music, playing guitar, singing songs, writing songs. And I woke up one day a few years ago and was like, oh, I want to act. And because I've always had a knack for cameras, photography, putting together scripts, improv, different things like that. I've always loved it. And so I got into acting, and creating scenarios and like putting videos up has been something I've always wanted to do, but never really thought that anyone cared to watch, basically. And so during the pandemic, like most millennials, I flocked to TikTok on a whim, and I sucked at it at first. And then out of nowhere, I had a video pick up some traction and like garner the attention of some blue check people, some, you know,
important people.
And I was just like, well, this is weird. And it was completely unpackaged. There was no real thought behind it. You know how that goes, where you go viral on accident. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, you know, what if I started doing more stuff like this? Because I really love it. I love content. That's the one thing that's been consistent. And so I just started doing more and more. And it turns out I apparently have a very infectious laugh, and people love to see me react to things. And I sprinkle some of my original content in there as well, you know, just thoughts, conversations, point of view, different things like that. And so it just, it's taken off. And so this time last year, I think I had about 30,000 followers, and I currently have 450,000. So
Ooh, it's fun,
like how it's growing so quickly, you know, and I can be in the presence of awesome people like you, who I can call mutuals, which is fantastic. But I think, like you said before, you know, it's just a really cool thing to meet people that you've never met, but you feel like, you know, like I feel like we know each other because I've known you through your content, and I feel like, you know, we're here. And yeah, it's just a fun, very 21st century way of existing.
Yeah, I read something the other day about like, or I think I saw a TikTok about it, which is such a modern thing for us to do. Go, I read an article about, I didn't read an article, I watched a TikTok about it. A TikTok about third spaces and how they're very important for communities, that like you have like your home and your job. Those are your first and second places that you go. And then there's these really important third spaces, gathering spaces, you know, restaurants. This is why like churches were so important in a lot of communities, as like a common gathering place for the community to come, where they don't have to be there for any financial gain or anything like that. It's just a space to come and be together with your neighbors. Mm-hmm. Movie theaters and theaters in general, dance clubs, dance halls, things like that. And we lost a lot of that with the pandemic, and we're losing some of that with just the modern digital age. But what's happening is that social media platforms are becoming a very prominent third space in our community, that like our gathering place is now places like TikTok and Twitter and Instagram, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because it doesn't feel like, well, at least for me, like I guess my followers corrected me. I thought that I was called an extroverted introvert, but apparently I'm an ambivert. And I feel like for people like me who enjoy social spaces, but also are a little more reserved and kind of need that alone space as well, it's a really beneficial way to still stay connected with people without having to like physically exert energy, being constantly around people all the time. I love a good live event, don't get me wrong, but like to have to do that every single day, I feel like it's way too much for my anxiety. But it has become as many problems as have come with TikTok, and you know, as well as I do, the videos being taken down, my account was on account warning for like 7 months this year. It just came off like last week. Yeah. You know, being reported, and you know, my content is all clean. I have very clean content. So like all of those things, it comes with that, the trolls, all that stuff. But then at the same time, during the pandemic, I was so alone outside of my immediate bubble. It really kept me going. It kept me creative, because without it, I may have just fizzled, honestly.
Yeah, for sure. It was necessary. I do always try to put the caveat on whenever I complain about TikTok or social media. I always try to be like, well, it has changed my life.
Yeah, right.
Undeniably. Yeah. And it has created an avenue for me to like do what I want to do and do what I love and be successful at it that didn't exist before. Yeah. And I owe it that. But it's also just, yeah, it can be incredibly frustrating with my account is on warning right now and has been for a few weeks now. And it's just, and of course it's in error. Like they were in error. They were wrong to take the video down that they took down, which is always the case. It's always like, no, you're wrong. But you know, I think that it's a young platform. If they want to succeed, if they want to continue to exist, they're going to have to address that stuff at some point, or they're going to fizzle out and die. But we're not here to talk about our job as content creators and TikTok. I did want to just sort of lay the groundwork of how we know each other and stuff. But I wanted to jump into the topic here for the episode. There is a new boogeyman out there for the conservative right that they are feeding to their voting base right now as midterms approach, and that you're hearing pop up more and more and more when people talk about what they're afraid of with their children and what's happening at schools. You know, last year and the year before that, I think the big topic was CRT, was critical race theory. It's still, you still hear it. Politicians are still running on a platform of, we're not going to have CRT in schools, even though it never was. So that's an easy campaign promise to keep because it never was in elementary schools. But now the new one, and this is maybe even, I don't know if it's more baffling. The CRT one is pretty baffling, mostly because it was like just a thing that wasn't actually happening in elementary schools, and they somehow sold it to people as though it was. But this is a thing that like, it has been a part of curriculums at the K-12 level kind of always. Like a big part of why kids go to school is to also be socially taught, is to be educated in like socialization and like how to socialize and how to interact with other people and how to be kind. And I mean, I remember like just learning things. There were things on the board from first grade, like TCOI, take care of yourself, which meant like keep your hands to yourself when we're watching a movie or something. If Bradley pokes you, you don't have to poke him back. TCOI, you know, keep your, you know, and just trying to teach people about like what you can control and what you can't control, that you can't control other people, and helping people just with social skills and how to function in the social world from a very young age. And that's all social and emotional learning really is, but it's sort of being packaged as this thing that people should be afraid of. Do you have a different definition of what social and emotional learning is, or do you have maybe a more comprehensive definition of what social and emotional learning actually is, if we were to start there, like what it actually is?
I mean, nothing that I've come up with before when I was kind of doing research to just make sure that I was abreast of the topic. I read that it is an educational method that aims to foster social and emotional skills within school curricula. And like you said before, I think you hit the nail right on the head. It's something that has been in existence for all of school. It's literally why people send their children to school, not just to learn, but to learn how to be around other kids. I have several friends who have opted into homeschooling for a myriad of reasons, but they still have groups that they send their kids to so that they can learn how to be socialized. Because anyone who has kids, and I don't have kids, but I've been around kids my entire life. I have a host of nieces and nephews and cousins that I've like babysat and everything. And you can tell the kids that are by themselves all the time, they don't know how to interact around other people. And that causes issues as they grow up. They don't know how to read social cues. They don't know how to read the room, which is a really important social skill for you to be successful in any capacity. Unless you're like in a basement somewhere working on computers for the rest of life and you don't see daylight unless you're going out to like get your newspaper, you need social skills. And even then, if you run into the newspaper guy, you need to know how to like not be, you know, a threat or something like that. So I think it's pretty ridiculous that this is being packaged in a political way to sway people. And they probably don't even care. Like if we start there, the politicians that are packaging it as like this thing to be afraid of probably don't even care about the topic at all. They're just hopping on the latest buzzword because people are scrutinizing this category of learning into something so much smaller than what it is.
Well, they they definitely, at least some of them, definitely don't care. And they actually are aware that they are misrepresenting what the idea is. And they, some of them are even very open about this. And I do actually want to talk about that. But sticking on just for a second here, sort of like the actual function of what I did this too. I did an episode on critical race theory a while back, and we started sort of with like, what is it actually? What are people saying it is? You know, like it, like the, so we can really parse those out. And I do want to talk about what they're saying that shows that they don't actually care and that they are aware that they are intentionally misrepresenting this idea. But in addition to like social skills, because you were talking about social skills are really important, and they are, being able to pick up social cues and just know how to interact with people, that is important. I also think that there's another layer to this, and this is the layer that people seem to be more concerned about, oddly. There's also this other layer of like how to empathize and how to have compassion and how to deal with people in like a humane way and in a respectful way. And in a way, like, you know, teaching people about like treat others the way that you would want to be treated, the golden rule, stuff like that, really basic principles that you're sort of taught from the foundation up. And this is a part of social and emotional learning that what's happening in schools today is part of teaching empathy and compassion is like trying to educate kids that, hey, in today's society, we are, it's more and more likely that you're going to have classmates who have two parents who are of the same gender, you know, who are married to each other, or you're going to have classmates that identify as non-binary or trans, or classmates that they themselves are gay or bisexual. And like, this is going to happen. Kids are going, when I was in school, nobody came out until after high school, you know, like all my friends that were queer, didn't come out till college because that's just the environment that we were in socially. This is in the 2000s, like we were not ready yet to be as open as we are now in schools. And also like gay marriage wasn't legal, but like we are, thankfully we have progressed to a point where it's more and more common that kids are going to encounter, you know, these sorts of situations. And, but this aspect of like teaching people how to be respectful, how to be compassionate has always been a part of curriculum, as we've discussed. But now that it's like including how to deal with otherness in a respectful way, we have a problem with it, which again, I feel like that was there when I was a kid too, that we talked about race stuff. And we talked, you know, like about how, like why our past was wrong, which that's the whole critical race theory thing is like, we don't want to teach kids that stuff. So that's a whole element too, is the empathy thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's such an interesting thing. You know, all things considered, all of the things that SEL covers, you know, self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, relationship skills, responsible decision-making, all of those things have to do with exactly what you said, being or making humane decisions, treating people with dignity and kindness and respect, being empathetic. It's basically exactly what I learned and what you mentioned already in school, the golden rule. That was the buzzword when I was in school. What's the golden rule? Treat others how you want to be treated. And it's just a simple concept that kids are able to learn. I'm a product of it. You're a product of it. I don't have to agree with you or agree with your lifestyle or understand what it is that you do or why you don't do or whatever to respect you and be kind to you. Like, and I feel like that's the part by and large that is missed, unfortunately, by so many different people, because they feel like everyone has to live in their shoes and to believe what they believe and feel how they feel. And if it's different, then it's wrong. And I think that that's where we miss it. And that's what ends up happening. You see these kids who are products of those type of environments grow up and have no empathy. And then we get school shootings because they don't value life. They don't value other people's life. Or then, you know, we get, you know, different terrorist attacks, or we get, you know, those are like extremes, but then we get bullies. We get bullies who don't know how to express their feelings, who don't know how to communicate what they're feeling or what they think, or how to reach across the aisle, so to speak, and meet you where you are. And so they feel like they have to be aggressive and all of these different things. And without it, I feel like there's just a downward trend that's impending.
Yeah, that's the thing, is it's not like, I mean, it's not like this being a part of the curriculum prevented us from having to deal with bullies or bad behavior when we were in school. It's not like it's 100% successful, but like, because yeah, bullying still happens even with SEL being a part of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And we know that this is a big problem in our school system, like the othering of certain kids for certain aspects of their identity, or just because they behave differently, or because they deal with a different array of mental health issues, whatever it is, or they're dealing with different circumstances at home, whatever it is. This definitely existed when I was in school, and SEL was on the table, and no one was freaking out about it. It still existed that kids acted out and mm-hmm. and bullied and othered and stuff like that. I think I participated in it. I think there was a desire to be accepted by a certain group at certain ages of my life, where I was like, oh, in order to be accepted by this group, I need to participate in the othering of this group. And I think it's a thing that happens amongst kids, and it really just highlights why SEL, if anything, should be focused on maybe more. I definitely don't think that the solution here is to go, well, if bullying exists anyway, let's just get rid of it. Mm. Yeah.
I would venture to say that, again, like you said, it still existed. It's not like things were perfect, but I think the progression of where we were versus where we are now, you can definitely tell a difference with the emphasis of taking certain things away as far as these conversations, right? And again, a lot of this is propaganda. A lot of this is political conversations. At least the small circle of people that I know, they're training their kids at home how to be decent human beings. So, you know, it doesn't mean that they, you know, don't come home fighting from school, or they don't deal with bullies, or, you know, maybe they have a moment where they're bullying or don't know how to share or say, I'm sorry. Like, that is life, exactly what you said. But at the same time, the same principles of SEL being taught on a grand spectrum, I agree, it should be dove into a little bit more, because it teaches us, I can't express this enough, like, how to be decent human beings. We've gotten to the point now where, and I feel like we've been desensitized, and I feel bad to even think I am also desensitized in a lot of ways, where I can like be scrolling and I see a video of someone being beaten, and for whatever reason, it could be race related, it could be, you know, nationality or ethnicity related, it could just be two people fighting, and we have become groomed to just watch it and be completely desensitized, unaware of the impact that it's having on us or on the people around us. And so if we're completely used to that, we rationalize in our minds that that's an acceptable way to react, you know. And that's just one example of how I feel like the further away we get from, you know, learning how to be empathetic, learning how to be aware of ourselves and of other people, you know, we'll go straight, I mean, we'll go further into those places where we are continuing the othering, where we are continuing isolating other people. And it just becomes worse. We become worse human beings at that point.
Absolutely. And I think then it brings up the question of like, okay, so, obviously, this isn't a thing that we need less of in society. I don't think that's a practical solution to like the fact that, oh, we still have a problem with school shootings. We still have a problem with a lack of empathy or a lack of compassion, and we still have a problem with bullying and things like this. Obviously, a solution to that wouldn't be let's get rid of it. So it brings up the question of like, why are people so intent on getting rid of this thing? And I think that we can look at this in a few ways. We can look at it in like, what are they being told SEL is that makes them think it should be something that, because there are some people who I think like are just being fed a line and they believe the line and they haven't actually bothered to investigate it further. And then I also think there are actors who are creating the line, who are crafting the lie that they are like the narrative around it. And I mean, like you mentioned, you have friends that are handling a lot of that at home and that are raising their kids to be compassionate people. Now, a lot of people who I think are opponents to this would say that that's actually their thing, is that they feel like it's not the school's job to teach their kids how to be respectful and compassionate. It's their job as parents. And they don't want the school handling that parenting duty. The parents should be the ones who are teaching their kids about
empathy and compassion and how to behave like a respectful person. It's not the school's job to teach them that. And that seems like a reasonable position, you know, on the surface. It seems like, yeah, okay, I can see that. I can see how you'll hear this all the time from people in school board meetings, like stick to math, English, science, the basics. Just teach my kid the basics about what they need to, you know, in the STEM fields and don't anything else about how to be a good person. I'll handle that at home. It seems like a reasonable position, but I think you have to dig deeper and go like, but why? Why are you so intent on making sure they don't hear any of this stuff at school? What are you afraid that the school is teaching them in the context of how to be a compassionate, empathetic person that you would rather handle at home? And I think we start getting into the more nefarious things of like, it starts more and more and more to look like, are you afraid that they're being taught that they should be kind to queer kids and that you would rather craft an environment at home where you say, hey, look, we're not cool with that in this house. And I don't want, because you hear the word indoctrination a lot mm-hmm. while people are talking about SEL from the right. They're like, I don't want teachers indoctrinating my kids with leftist propaganda. When really all the teachers are doing is trying to just preach empathy and compassion.
Mm-hmm. So here's very interesting. And I'm really glad that I'm your guest for this particular episode, because I think I have a really unique perspective. So first of all, the friends that I have that are kind of taking on the responsibility of that SEL primarily for their kids homeschool. So they don't get that opportunity to go to an actual school to be impacted by that kind of lesson plan. Mm-hmm. That being said, I would, if none of my friends did homeschooling, right? And to the parents that are completely against SEL and feel like that's the duty of the parent, I would caution those parents to think, who are your kids more awake with? If they're at school for 9 hours a day, they come home for a few hours, do homework, eat dinner, and then go to bed. They spend more time with the teachers and with their classmates than they do at home with you. So I would think if you feel like you can cram all of that in over the dinner table and with, you know, food and homework in a span of maybe 3 or 4 hours that you're actually home, especially when you're competing with social media, television, streaming sites, whatever it is, like, my hat off to you. But I don't know too many people who can do that successfully, who can combat 9 hours of schoolwork and you've got work and all those different things, and then think that you're going to have that kind of an impact in just that small window of time. So I think that it's important to like be for real, like in all honesty, just
I honestly don't know if all of these people actually are genuine when they say, I want to handle that. I almost think that they're like, oh no, I'm not actually going to like teach my kid about empathy and compassion. I just don't want the school filling their heads with all this nonsense about why they need to be kind to Muslim kids. And, and you know, it's like, I think some of these people are like, yeah, I don't actually have any plans on sitting down with my kid and doing a lesson plan on compassion and empathy. I'm saying the line, I'd rather handle that as a parent, when really what I mean is, I just don't want you telling my kid something that goes against my political ideology or now, yeah.
Now see, that being said, right? So for me, I have my faith beliefs. There are certain things that I align my life with. However, and it's an interesting conversation because I have people that I know who are like completely conservative and they're, you know, they're pro-life and they're pro this and they're pro that and they're anti that. My faith belief is I have a relationship with Jesus. That's between me and Jesus. What you do in your home or with your life, I don't have anything to do with that. Mm-hmm. I wish you well. I hope that you are a responsible and a kind human being, and I intend to be that to you. But I can't dictate to you what you do and who you are and how you live your life. It's only my responsibility to treat you with kindness and respect. Because you're a human being, no matter what you believe, no matter who you love, no matter what you wear, you are a human being. And I feel like, unfortunately, that is a cop-out when it comes to conservative people who buy into this propaganda of, oh, you know, let's just leave everything off the table when it comes to school, just stick to the subjects. No, because your student is not able to focus because someone keeps picking on them because of the color shirt they wore today. And so right. How can they possibly pass the math quiz if they're running to the office with a bloody nose for being punched because they wore a pink shirt? Like, it's, you know, you have to acknowledge the realities of things, because the things that we're not talking about in conservative homes, there are queer kids sometimes.
Yep.
You gotta address those things. So what are you only nice to your kid?
That's such an excellent point that it's like, first of all, so again, if we take this position that people just go, hey, look, I would just be more comfortable as a parent if I could handle that stuff on my own. And if you guys just stuck to math and English and, you know, but it's like, it's denying the reality that whether you like it or not, this stuff comes up at school all the time.
Yeah.
Kids clash and kids butt heads and kids bully each other for the color of shirt that they have on, and dumb shit like this happens every single day at school. Teachers can't just ignore it and say, sorry, I'm not allowed to talk about that because your parents have asked that they be the only ones that talk to you about how to treat each other in a humane, respectful mm-hmm. way. You know, they voted on it and they made sure that we can't say anything in school. We can't say anything school about how our country has a very troubled history with racism and white supremacy. Not allowed to say that anymore because that's critical race theory, even though that's not what critical race theory is. But now that's what they're saying it is. And now I can't say if someone gets bullied in school in front of me, I can't say anything anymore because we're not allowed to do social and emotional learning here at okay. school. So I have to just, every time there's a conflict in school, we have to call the parents and the parents have to come and deal with it privately. And obviously parents do get called for a lot of conflicts at school, but it would not be practical for the school to call the parents every single time.
They'd never be at work. They might right. as well work at the school.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great point, that it happens at school, whether or not you like it. And also that on the flip side, you thinking that you can control your home and that you can make sure. I always think this with very rigid people with very rigid beliefs. Unlike your belief where you're like, hey, my relationship with God is my relationship with God, and my responsibility to other people is just to love them. There are certain people that feel like their responsibility, their relationship with God gives them yokes them with the responsibility to make sure that everyone in their life also has that same relationship with God and in the same way. And you see this, that they feel like they can run their home in a way where they can ensure that none of their kids are gay or trans and it's like, that's just not how reality works. It doesn't matter how much you want that to be the case. You're not going to be able to control if one of your kids is queer or not. Like you're just not going to be able to control that. Yeah. So on both sides, it's like, yeah, you might want to be able to control that narrative as a parent. You might want to be the person who is the sole provider of social and emotional learning for your child. And you also might want to be the sole provider of your child's ideology and personality. That's anybody who's ever had kids knows that's just not how it works with kids. And anybody who's ever taught school knows that's just not how it works at a school. You can't just ignore the social aspect of rearing a child and bringing a child up.
I mean, at the meat of it, right? I've gotten into many a debate, which I try not to get into these debates with my fellow Christians, because, you know, I hate arguing and I don't have the time to argue. But I often point to people like, first of all, when it comes to judging other people, the only responsibility that we have as far as, you know, looking in on people and encouraging people in the faith are, in fact, with people that are in the faith. And so it's really not our responsibility to have a say-so with people that don't believe what we believe. And then even at that point, right, it doesn't give us authority to bash people and to tear people down and to tell people you're going to hell and, you know, God doesn't love you, because none of that is true, right? Mm-hmm. I can't send anyone to hell. I can't, you know what I mean? Like that responsibility doesn't weigh on my shoulders. That has nothing to do with me. My responsibility, the greatest commandment, is to love God and to love others. And that's not the only commandments, but those are the greatest commandments. And so just from a religious perspective, I feel like sometimes we get so caught up in the don't, which is like the whole legalistic view of religion, rather than we looking at what faith is supposed to be about, which is love and compassion and right living, because you draw more people in being a kind human being. I don't understand why that's such a far-fetched idea, as if it's just the worst thing that your child can be, is kind to another human being. I've never understood that, whether it's because of race, whether it's because of, you know, gender identity or whatever. Like, I don't understand why that's such a difficult thing. But as I said before, you know, if someone wants to take on that responsibility, then take on the entire responsibility. Homeschool your kids. There's nothing wrong with that. If you are very passionate about that, if it's that important to you, homeschool your child. But if you expect for your child to try to exist in a capacity where there are going to be several different types of people from several different types of backgrounds and all these different types of beliefs, and you want there to be no type of, what did they call it when I was in school? Conflict resolution. All of that involves SEL.
Yeah.
It overlaps it. It's the umbrella of it. And so it's disruptive at that point because I can't focus. I remember when I was in school, I used to get bullied for a myriad of reasons, and it made it difficult for me to pay attention in class. I mean, what are they going to do? I get in trouble. They pull me to the side and talk to me about it. They address it. They try to course correct. But if they can't do that now, it disrupts the classroom. It disrupts my ability to learn and the other person's ability to learn. Then we go home and our parents tell us, well, this is what you're supposed to do. Then we go back to school and it's the exact same commotion and chaos because we're not going to the same home. It's ridiculous to me.
Yeah. It really begs the question, like, how did we get here? Like, how did something that really should not have been controversial, just understanding that social and emotional learning is a part of learning, that like part of what we're doing at school is just like learning how to be people. Humans take a long time to develop. I was talking the other day about like just words and language, and how like a word is just a symbol that represents a concept. And the more you investigate every word and every concept, the richer and more complex they become. We can give things really like rigid, simple definitions, and everyone will always be like, well, the dictionary says it's this. And it's like, well, even that's insufficient. If you actually really want to explore the thing and all the different aspects of the thing, I was talking about the word woman and Matt Walsh's documentary, What is a Woman? And which is a whole thing that feeds into how SEL became a topic, but it just the concept of the word woman philosophically and linguistically, and Matt Walsh's definition of it is it's an adult human female, and people feel like that's a really succinct definition. But the problem is, it's like, well, what is an adult? First of all, let's break that down. And people were like, an adult is a person who's reached sexual maturity. And it's like, what specifically does that mean in biological terms? Because does that mean that like, like for a girl that she started ovulating, that happens sometimes at 11 years old, sometimes at 12, sometimes at 13. Is that an adult in biological terms? In America, legally, we say that an adult is 18. In other countries, it's 16 or 15. Countries sort of decide this, legally and through the government, sort of arbitrarily, but it's really a cultural concept. Like different cultures have like adulthood rites and rituals where it's like you go through this thing. Now, according to this culture, you're an adult. There's bat mitzvahs and bar mitzvahs for the Jewish culture of you are now a man. Happens like 13 or 14 years old sometimes. I was literally joking with a friend, but I'm not kidding. I'm like, I don't think I was an adult till I was 30. It took me a long time. Like it takes people different, like part humans take a long time to bake is my point. And
I'm still in an oven, so don't feel bad.
Yeah. And part of that is like, we are constantly learning how to not just how to do math better. In fact, I was done learning how to do math better a long time ago, but I'm constantly having to learn how to interact in a more compassionate way with people and in a more empathetic way with people. Yeah. It really brings up that question of like, how did we get here to this place where a thing that should not be controversial has become controversial? How do you think we got here?
So I, Oh, that's such a hard question, I think, because there are all of these different trails of things, right? So as far as I can think back, when I was in grammar school, I went to a grammar school in inner city Chicago. It was predominantly African American. We learned the traditional like history of this country, but we also learned the other history of this country because the school administrators were very adamant about making sure that Black kids knew what happened to Black people. Right. And so I kind of had a bit of a culture shock when I went to high school, where it was predominantly white school, all white teachers, you know, those different things. So I bring that up because when you have like that layout of what the history of this country is and how we got to where we are today, by and large, you know, people would say our forefathers were of the Christian faith and they laid out rules and regulations for this country based on that. But then, you know, there's this back and forth between this is a Christian nation, you know, God bless America. And then you go into, you know, all of these different splits, all of the different wars, keep church and state separate. You know, it's a lot of conflicting views. So I really feel like a lot of this really rests in politics, right? Because before there was this power grab for who's in charge, I would like to assume that there were just families trying to survive. Mm-hmm. And I think while that is a really big concept, I can't help but think that that's really where the problem is rooted in who's in charge. Because like we said earlier, a lot of these politicians have even stated that they really don't care about this whole concept. They just really want to vote because they want to be in power. And they're making these promises. Sometimes they follow through on it. Sometimes they don't. And they don't even care to break down what this concept actually is and what it does for people. And so I feel like, you know, people have boiled this concept of SEL down to, if we're being frank, a way to make gay okay, a way to teach my kids to be okay with the gay lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And it's like, whether or not they teach that in school, that's just where we are.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to just deal with that. Otherwise, you're just walking through life like that. I mean, honestly, that's where we are. It's everywhere. And you just have to teach your child how not to be a butthole about it. And so like, I think it started with that, this idea that we are founded on these certain principles, even though we weren't. Like, if you really, really look at the progression of America, what we claim to be founded on, it's inconsistent.
You know, well, it's actually, if it's anything, it's ideological pluralism. The Church of England was the only option for religion, and people were seeking the ability to start their own churches and to worship in different ways. I mean, even like the Mayflower Compact on the Mayflower was like, there were pagans and Christians, I think, or pagans and Quakers. There were two different groups of people on the Mayflower coming over, and they couldn't decide what they wanted to be when they got there. And they came up with a compact on the boat saying like, all right, we're going to have to try to do this in a pluralistic way. Mm-hmm. And from the foundation of the country, it was all people who say it's a Christian nation. I'm like, yeah, we have a lot of Christian religions here, but that's sort of the point, is we have a lot. It's about pluralism. It's mm-hmm. about the fact mm-hmm. that like it is an ideologically pluralistic nation, and mm-hmm. very early on the idea of separation of church and state came in. So yeah, I think that there is sort of a fundamental misunderstanding of like why the country was founded and what it was founded on the principles of.
It's weird. It's weird to think about even beginning that conversation of these are the principles that the country was founded on, but also we stole the country and we claimed it as our own and we bought people and all these different
things. Built it on the backs of,
It's very inconsistent. And so I feel like in the concept of SEL and what it has been portrayed as, by and large, especially by politicians and just different political groups, I feel like it's this buzzword that people hold on to try to assert this idea of the great establishment of America. Everybody idolizes this idea that we came here and we conquered and we discovered and we're the greatest nation on earth. And don't get me wrong, like, I value the benefits that I've had of growing up in Chicago and the life that I live, but it's not lost on me that there are a lot of times we are the laughing stock of the world. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate. And I feel like we really just have to stop. We just really have to stop, take a step back and think, like, are we really who we claim to be? And this idea of ignoring SEL and the benefits that it has at home, like, it's not helping us be who we claim to be.
Yeah. As I researched this, it really is just so, and that's so great. First of all, just a little side note, Bonnie Allen in our comments says that the human brain isn't structurally complete until 26, developmental studies suggest. So it could be true that I didn't become a full adult till 30 and that we're both still
I think I probably still look like 23, so I'm still baking.
Yeah, you look great. It's remarkable how similar the situation really is to the critical race theory panic situation. And it's very, I mean, it's similar in all the same ways where it's like what people did not like and what people were uncomfortable with and what people needed to a way to give voice to was they did not like. And I was surprised when I did my research on critical race theory when it was first becoming a hot topic, and I was like, okay, what is this? And what do I need to know about it? When I was doing an episode on that and doing videos on it, I was surprised to find out, kind of like you were, that like different states and different areas teach the history of the slave trade and the Civil War differently, and the civil rights movement. And like, I mean, I thought I had a pretty comprehensive education on it. And then I found out from the show Watchmen on HBO about the Tulsa massacre. And I was like, I was never taught that in school. My schooling went like founding of America, the slave trade. Like, we did that. We did the whole unit on like roots, and like we read all about that. And then it's like the Civil War, Emancipation Proclamation, nothing, civil rights movement in the 60s. Everything's better, nothing. And it's like, well, that's not comprehensive at all, is it? Like, that's not actually very comprehensive. And I come to find out, I was actually in like one of the good states that does a pretty decent job. There are other states that do it way worse, that have like 1 year of middle school where they cover it in like one history course for a brief time. And it's sort of like, oh, wow, we really aren't getting the same information across the board. We're not getting the same info. And even with our inadequate teaching on it, the bottom line is these narratives being taught to children make people who maybe aren't comfortable with this title, but this is what they are, like white supremacists, uncomfortable. Like, they don't like knowing that this is being taught to their kids in school, that this information, they couch it in this way of like, do you know who Christopher Rufo is? Do you know this guy?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's the guy that popularized the talking point of critical race theory. And he's actually one of the engineers of the panic around social and emotional learning. Mm-hmm. No surprise there. And he's one of the engineers of the current push to like make sure that states have anti-trans laws and things like that. Yeah. And he's very, to his weird credit, he's very like open about his tactics. Like, he was very open about how with critical race theory, he was like, we're going to give parents and families who have this underlying discomfort already about teachers telling their kids about race and the history of racism in America. They don't know how to name it, because if they were really being honest, they would just say, I don't know, I'm kind of just racist. And like, I just don't like hearing about it.
Maybe.
People aren't even comfortable self-identifying as that. Unconscious bias is a real thing. If it were conscious, it wouldn't be unconscious. So you tell people like, you might have unconscious bias, and they're like, no, I don't. It's like, well, you wouldn't know if you did. That's the whole thing about unconscious bias. But like, yeah, it's like, you wouldn't. Yeah, exactly. But if they could have language to be honest about what it is, they would just say, I'm uncomfortable with the topic because it makes me feel bad about being part of the historical group that subjugated this other group. But critical race theory, couching it in this catch-all term, it gives them this this sort of out where they're like, oh, well, this is a Marxist indoctrination tool. And now they can sort of have these like big academic sounding words that don't sound like they're rooted or couched in white supremacy or just in general discomfort due to unconscious bias. And the same thing is happening with social and emotional learning. They can use things like saying it's a left-wing indoctrination tool to groom kids, you know, use terms that sound like we're doing something really inappropriate with kids when really we're just trying to teach kids how to be compassionate human beings. Because if they were being honest about what actually is at the root of it is I'm uncomfortable with my kid being told that it's normal for someone to use they, them pronouns. That makes me uncomfortable. And I can't really express why adequately without, if I'm to be honest, it would just be, I just sort of have an internalized bias against people who identify in different ways that I don't fully understand. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to say that because that just sounds like I'm a bad person or a person who needs to learn more. So what Christopher Rufo and these politicians that we talked about earlier, the people who know better, who know that it's, they're giving everyone an out. They're giving them a topic and say, no, say it's this thing. Say that it's just that you're worried about teachers overstepping their bounds with your kids, that they're teaching kids that they shouldn't be teaching them about, that the parents should be teaching them about, giving them things that sound more reasonable. Mm-hmm. And it's a fascinating strategy, to say the least.
It kind of reminds me of these big pharma companies that like come out with this miracle drug that is actually probably more poisonous than whatever it is it's supposed to cure. And so it's like, hey, you know, we'll cure this one thing, but also here are the side effects. And they say it really fast and really low. So it's like, oh, you know, just call SEL this thing right here. They're overstepping. But also if we take it away, if you take this drug, there could also be more of this, that, and the other. And this gets overlooked and this person gets hurt and this person is misunderstood and so forth. And it's like, you really have to be more natural about it, right? If you, and I've said this plenty of times during the whole conversation and the ongoing conversation of critical race theory, when it comes to race, when it comes to biases or, you know, differences of opinion of any kind, right? Our nation has a really big problem with being uncomfortable.
Oh yeah.
And I get that. Like nobody likes to be uncomfortable. It starts with un. It's already like a negative prefix of the word when you really break it down. But like that doesn't make it go away. Sometimes yeah. You have to be comfortable being uncomfortable in order to grow, in order to develop, in order to be a better human. I don't agree with, you know, people who have biases against Black people, but that doesn't mean that I get to just treat them however I want to treat them because I'm a respectable human being and they're still a human being. It doesn't give me justification to just do whatever it is that I want to do because they don't like me. Mm-hmm. You know, if they harm me, that's one thing. But if they just simply don't like me, okay, well, not everybody's going to like me. And I have to be comfortable with that uncomfortable feeling. And I think that if we spent as a nation more time addressing the things that are uncomfortable, like really sitting in it, it would give us a better understanding of how to be more compassionate human beings. Like as uncomfortable as a conservative person might be with their children learning that Sally Sue has two moms at home, how uncomfortable do you think it is for Sally Sue to have her entire class look at her like, why do you have two moms? That she's a kid. It's uncomfortable.
Exactly.
She's a kid. She's a child. You as an adult should, you know, be able to understand, hey, that's how her house is. That's not how our house is, you know.
Yes.
Keep it moving. Like, you know, be kind. You know what I mean? And I feel like I have to be honest. I have to own up to it, right? I want to speak directly to the people who may be like me, who have a Christian upbringing, a Christian background, and who have struggled with this. Because initially, when this first started becoming like a more prominent conversation, let's say 10 years ago, right? Where it wasn't uncommon for people to come out just whenever. Like they could be in high school, they could be in middle school, and it was happening really fast. And it wasn't what I was used to when I was growing up, because like you said, a lot of times it was after high school.
Yes.
And so I had to like really sit and like think about, well, what does this mean for me? Because this challenges everything that I've grown up believing. This challenges everything that I've been taught in my Catholic schools. Well, what do I do with this information? And one day I was led to like ask questions. So I started befriending some people, some queer people, trans people, gay people, all those different things. Just asking questions. What is it like for you? What is it like for you to walk down the halls? Do you feel safe here? Do you feel like you have real friends? You know, and then when they would find out that I was Christian, they would all be so surprised. Like, you're so nice. You're so this, you're so that. Or even people who aren't, you know, in a queer community, maybe they're atheists. I've had atheists say, you know, I don't believe in God, but wow, you're, you know, I really appreciate your kindness. And that's when it like really struck me, is that we have a kindness problem. We have a kindness crisis in this country, because we're so focused on forcing other people to believe what we believe, whatever that is, because we're a melting pot. Like, the we is not inclusive. And so this small we is forcing everybody else to believe what they want to believe. And it's like, okay, we're missing the kindness factor, because the reality of it is that we live in a world full of different people from different backgrounds with different ideologies. And there's nothing we can do about that.
Yeah. It seems to me that a big part of the cure and the remedy is curiosity. Like, what I hear in your story there is that you had the option to either dig your heels in and go, no, I know what I believe and I know what I feel about these kinds of people, or to go, well, I have my beliefs and I have my positions, but I've never actually spent any significant time with these people. I've never actually bothered to be very curious about their experience. Yeah. Let's see what happens if I ask more questions. Yeah. And I think that that's with all this stuff, it's like, that's kind of what this is about with SEL, is it's like, you hear a bunch of people yelling, oh, we got to get SEL out of schools. Well, you start with, well, what's that? What's SEL? I haven't even heard that. Yeah. A lot of people ask, like, well, what is that? Okay, it's social and emotional learning. What is that? What is social and emotional learning? You learn more about it. Oh, that kind of sounds like a thing that I was already raised with. Why are people upset about it? You dig deeper. You keep asking questions. Oh, they're upset because they feel like the teachers are imparting, especially in this modern context, ideas to their kids that they're not comfortable with, because maybe the teachers are saying that you should be nice to or accept gay or trans or non-binary people as they are. And I'm not, and people aren't comfortable with that. And you start thinking, yeah, maybe people should have the right to stand up for their, you know, own religious ideals or ideology. And maybe that's a reasonable thing. But you keep digging deeper, like, okay, but what happens if we lose social and emotional learning in schools? What happens if we no longer are teaching about the history of racism in schools at all? Like, as we already covered, it's already grossly insufficient, but keep asking questions, keep pulling the thread. Can we afford to not have these things talked about in schools? Is that actually better? Is that safer for kids who are already being bullied, kids who are already being othered? Is it better for society that we talk less about these things that make certain people uncomfortable? Because that's really what curiosity does, is it puts you into uncomfortable situations. Talking to people that have an experience that is different from yours that you don't understand is uncomfortable. Yeah. There's a fear there of like what might be revealed to you about your, you might learn something about yourself that you're like, oh shit, I've been operating in a way for a while that's problematic. Like, I've been up and that means I have to like sit in that. I have to like own that. And that's, people would rather avoid that. But I really think curiosity is a big key to the puzzle here and to figuring out how to inject more kindness into our society.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think, you know, during like 2020 and even last year with all of these conversations about race, what I found, like my way of coping, because I got to a point where I was so angry because the narrative was constantly this divide, you know, and it's so funny because Christopher Rupo talks about this divisive language a lot of the time. And it's like a lot of the time in those political conversations, they insert divisive language. But then they insert divisive language, calling out divisive language. And it's like, pick one. Are you divisive? Are you calling out divisive? And so when it comes to like those conversations, I decided instead of being angry and feeling like every white person I know is racist, because I knew that wasn't true based on personal experience. I knew that wasn't true, but that's all I was being fed. I went out of my way to seek out conversations with people who did not look like me and ask them questions, ask them what their upbringing was, ask them what their belief was, ask them if they've had these conversations with their children and different things like that. And it was, some of the conversations were a little uncomfortable, but every one of them, both parties walked away feeling like we can bridge the gap. A lot of times they would say, I just didn't know. I didn't know that's how you felt. I didn't realize that I did that or so forth. And so by the same token, the conversations that I've had with people in the queer community, the same thing. I've just learned so much from them. I've learned about what they go through. I've learned about how they feel about themselves. I've learned about how they feel about others. And I think one of the biggest issues about dismantling SEL in the school system, again, we've already covered that our kids spend majority of their day with these teachers, with their peers. And so if you take that away, yeah, okay, you might think that no one can really talk to them about, you know, the queer community. But also that means no one can talk to them about, you know, what your beliefs are. They can't calm someone down from picking on you because you believe in God or you believe in Allah or you believe in whoever. They can pick on you for whatever and no one can say anything because we've taken out SEL.
Right.
It doesn't just live in the queer community. It covers everything, all the differences that make us this great nation. Right. And we have to, where people are stabbing themselves in the foot at that point by disregarding the complete impact because they're focusing in on this one point that really isn't even the thing.
Well, and that's that. I mean, if we really want to go back to what we were talking about, the founding of the country, that like rather than being founded as like a solely Christian nation, instead looking at it as a nation that was founded with the ideal of ideological pluralism, social and emotional learning can be looked at more like that, that instead of teaching Christian kids that they have to abandon themselves of the belief that it's sinful to be gay or something like that, instead of telling them that they're the like the what they were taught at church is wrong or something like that, it could just be teaching them you're allowed to have your beliefs and even still you need to treat other people with respect and dignity and with in a humane way.
Yes.
And vice versa from them to you. And it's respect is earned by being given. So like if you want their respect, if you want them to respect that you have a particular deeply held personal religious belief, you need to show them respect as well. So, and it will be hopefully reciprocal. And that's really, I think, what we want in this country is the idea of being able to have ideological pluralism. I've talked a lot about this with like the abortion debate with people that I'll say the only way for both ideas to be represented and respected is for it to be legal. And people think, no, that means that only people who are pro-choice are getting represented. And it's like, no, actually, the only way for both people to be represented is for it to be legal, because that means that if you don't believe in it and you think that it's wrong, there's no law that says that you have to have an abortion. There's no law that's forcing you to go against your belief system. You get to have your belief. And I won't fight you on that. And I don't think anyone wants to fight you on that. Yeah. But since we have an ideological divide on that topic, and some people really do believe that people should have bodily autonomy and medical freedom and access to healthcare, especially if it means that their life is at risk because they have an ectopic pregnancy or something like that, they should be allowed to do that. And that the only way we can have both sides honored is if it's legal and accessible.
Yeah.
And I think that that's sort of the same thing here with SEL, is it seems like the left is winning somehow, or like progressives are winning somehow because they're getting their indoctrination into school. But really, if we could try somehow, I don't know how to get this out there, but to reframe it as like, really, this is about respect going both ways and for everyone.
Yes.
I think that's a really great reframe there that you brought up. So,
yeah. And it continues to like baffle me, for lack of a more creative word, because the whole crux of like this conservative viewpoint, when you look at, even if it's, you know, what did you call it?
Ideological pluralism,
yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Even within that, there's this underlying thread of the golden rule, which is in the Bible. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's this whole idea of treat people well, treat people with kindness, be merciful, be this, all these different things. So it's like you think that it would be ingrained.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean for whatever reason, people take it as a threat to what we believe. Everyone is entitled to believe what they believe, no matter what that means. If you told me, Austin, I believe that 2 + 2 = 5. And there's nothing you can do to change me. hey, that's your belief. You have the ability to count your coins, my guy. And that's, there's nothing I can do about that. Like, I know what I believe, but if that's what you believe, then that's your money. I wouldn't give you my money, but that doesn't mean I'm going to treat you like crap because you count differently than I do. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. But then if I heard that the school was teaching kids that 2 + 2 = 4 or something like that, or, and then I said, well, that's hard, that's offensive to me. So I tried to make laws that made it so that everyone has to say that it's 5 or something like that.
It's crazy. You know? It's craziness. Yeah. And it's sad because I feel like it keeps us in such a regression. Like, if people want to make America great again or whatever, then it's like, we could just make America great. You know, we can like actually try to be the most powerful nation in the world, actually try to be the greatest nation in the world by being kind. I'm reading this book right now on organizational health, and it talks about how this guy, he's built his entire life's career and success on helping organizations become healthy. He talks about how a lot of times he's seen it time and time again where he'll have clients who are the smartest. They went to the Ivy League schools, they graduated top of their classes, they have all the money, they have all the resources, but their competition wins out every time. And it's because they don't have healthy organizations. And he also talks about how that's not just true in business, but that's true in church, that's true in life, really. And so what he talks about in the book, and I'm not finished with it yet, but what he talks about as far as organizational health is a lot of what SEL talks about, right? Just mm-hmm. being self-aware, treating people with kindness, accepting responsibility for when you're wrong, you know, having conflict resolution, agreeing to disagree, making sure that you sit in uncomfortable situations so that you can grow from it. All of those different things promote organizational health, which inspire your employees to work better. They enjoy coming to where they are to do their jobs because they feel healthy as an organization. And I feel like that's an opportunity that we have yet to really take advantage of as a nation, because we don't want to sit in that discomfort. Like as a whole, right? A lot of people, the people who have those platforms that run these ads and that make these laws, they don't want to sit in what's uncomfortable. If it causes them to lose money, if it causes them to accept responsibility for their errors, if it causes them to have to go back on something that they originally said, even if they're already doing that in private. Like, if we would just be more healthy as a country, and a lot of this is taught in SEL, how much further would we would really be a great nation? You know, we would really, really, we would be the nation that we tell other people that we are.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing about the American experiment is like, it is really unique in a lot of, one of the things that makes it so unique is just how culturally, diverse America is, that whether people like it or not, the people who try to insist that this, we should be a Christian nationalist nation, that we should be a Christian theocracy, it's like, well, we just aren't a nation made up of a bunch of Christian people who just want to live in a Christian nation. That's just not what America is. America is much more culturally, religiously, theocratically, you know, intellectually diverse mm-hmm. than that. And that's sort of the beauty and the difficulty of the experiment. That's also the challenge of the experiment. Like a lot of nations that we look at that we go, that nation really seems to have it together. That country really seems to have things moving in the right direction. You know, we look at like Japan or Norway or like places that we look at like, oh, their healthcare is a lot better and stuff. One thing that these nations have is that they're very culturally, ethnically, theocratically homogenous. Like they don't have a lot of diversification outside of there is like a very clear national norm mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. what and majority. And this is why ideological pluralism is difficult, is like what we probably should be trying to do as America, trying to lead the charge into like the progressive future of like, watch how great we can be, just like you're saying, is figuring out a way to make our diversity our strength, figuring out a way to make our cultural diversity work for us. Mm-hmm. And right now we sort of seem to have a mindset politically of like, who's going to win? whose ideology is going to win, who's going to set the code for morals and ethics in the country, who's going to be the people who get to write the moral and ethical code into law. And there seems to be one team that's very rigid, that's like, we want to win for a particular brand and interpretation of Christianity. And I think there seems to be another side that it looks like they're trying to win for a particular agenda of like, we just want to make everyone trans or everyone gay. I don't think that's actually what that agenda is. I think that agenda is more about, we just want a spot for everyone. Yeah. We just want to make sure everyone, regardless of how they identify, has a spot, has a voice, and that we can lean on our differences to make us stronger.
Yeah.
That's at least what I'm hoping for, is that we can make this experiment of cultural diversity, of pluralism, work.
I really love the way that you call it an experiment, because it is. I've never really considered it that way, but it definitely is an experiment. It kind of reminds me of marriage. You know, I've been married for 5 years, and the thought of living with a guy for life, I wasn't prepared. You know, you come with these differences of opinion and the way we were brought up. I think that the towel should be folded one way and he thinks it should be folded the other, or, you know, he's an early riser, I'm a night owl, you know, and it's like you find this way out of respect for the two people, you know, out of respect and love for one another, and the agreement that you want to coexist and not kill each other. You find a way to coexist. And it doesn't mean that you agree on everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my husband loves green bean casserole. I can't stand the stuff, but that doesn't mean I'm going to like move his stuff into boxes out on the front porch. You know,
right.
You learn how to coexist in a way that is how people will say is really cliche, but better together. Right.
Yeah.
We come together. We learn how to be better together. Our differences, we really play on those things. I'm really good with creative things. He's really good strategizing, you know, and those are both of our strengths that we use together to make a fantastic home for ourselves. And I feel like exactly what you said with this experiment, we are doing something different. You know, we're not all the same. We're probably one of the most diverse countries there is, because a lot of people come here for a new start. They come here to try something else. And that's what makes America unique. It's all of its differences. Mm-hmm. And we have to figure out how to work together and just not silence everybody. It doesn't mean that everyone is going to conform to one idea or the other. It's literally the opposite, right? Everyone is who they are. And we just get along. We respect one another. We are kind. We're good human beings.
Well, thank you so much for being a Christian person who understands that giving voice to other people does not mean silencing your own, and that respecting other people does not mean sacrificing respect for your own beliefs and your own relationship with God as you understand God. Thank you so much for being a great example of how that can work. This has been a really nice conversation.
I
want to let you get back to your day. I feel like I've taken too much of your time. Where can people follow you if they want to keep up with the message from Crystal Luster?
All of my social media is at Crystal Luster, and my website, crystalluster.com. So that's Crystal, C-H-R-I-S-T-A-L, Luster. If you think about it, it's the shiniest name you'll ever see. I just shine all day. A crystal that lusters.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I got a lot of cool stuff coming up. And we still have to do that awesome music collaboration. I have not. We're going to have to do that. But thank you so much for having me. This has been great. I'm a huge fan, and this is great. I really appreciate it.
Crystal, thank you so much. This was excellent. I'm so glad that it was you for this topic. I think it went really well.
I agree.
So thank you.
Yeah.
We'll hopefully have you back on the show again soon, and we'll also work on that music project as well.
Yes, please.
Okay. See you later.
Okay, see you. If anyone is gonna stay with you, that's not something you can control.
So there it is. Did you know it? Did you know that? Did you know that people were freaking out about that? Did you know what SEL was before this episode? What are your thoughts? Let me know. Reach out. Say hi. Again, follow Crystal. Keep up with everything she's doing. Keep up with her content. It's great. Thanks again to Crystal for being here. Hopefully we get her back on sometime soon.
Yeah, I don't really have much else to say about it. I felt like we did a nice job with it, you know, the whole like antidote. I think we came to a nice landing place there at the end, like the antidote being curiosity and kindness. And that's, you know, it's good to hear from a person who has the religious conviction that perhaps, I mean, we didn't really get into it, but like it's totally possible that Crystal has the conviction that like that being gay is goes against like God's plan and stuff. But she is a Christian person who also understands, you know, pluralism, and understands how to honor diversity and how to be okay with being around people who have different belief sets, and how to harbor an environment where different belief sets can coexist peacefully. And that's nice to hear. So yeah, all right, that's the show. Hey, patreon.com/AustinArcher. I talk about this usually at the very, very end of the show, typically. But why not just talk about it right now before I do the end credits and just get it in there a little bit earlier and say that if you haven't ever checked it out, why not check it out? Go see what's going on over there. We have a good time from time to time. And mostly I just want to let the Patreon patrons know how much I love them and know how significant their contribution to this operation is. It really is. It's it means a lot. And so thanks to all of you who are doing that, anyone who has done it in the past at any time. And just thank you all for listening week after week. I really, really appreciate it, okay? I appreciate you. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com. That's my website. AustinArcherMusicBandcamp.com. That's my other website. Or by looking up Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music. That's the other places that you can find the music. And then I'm also on all the internet things as well. The show's on YouTube now. You can go watch me and Crystal talking on YouTube. You can find us on YouTube. You can see our pretty faces if you want to go watch the video format. And if you haven't already subscribed to that YouTube channel, all right? Okay, take it easy. We'll see you next week. Love you so much. Ooh, get registered. Get registered. Midterms are coming up. If you're still listening, if you haven't turned it off yet, get registered and go vote. All right? Let's rock that. Let's keep it rolling. All right? Okay. Talk to you next week. Love you. Bye bye.
If you think that two souls cannot love for that long, grow your jaded ass up and know that you're wrong. Because 60 years is not near.